From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters on Juneteenth. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Juneteenth is now a national holiday after decades of denial of having the status of an official day of celebration and reflection about enslavement and the struggle for freedom. The 19th of June, 1865, is now venerated as a federal holiday. On Juneteenth is a new book of essays about this day and about Texas, written by Pulitzer Prize-recognized historian Annette Gordon Reed. I asked her to read from the book a passage about how she celebrated Juneteenth as a child growing up in Conroe, Texas.
We children celebrated with the fireworks my grandfather bought, setting off firecrackers and sparklers well into the night. The traditional Juneteenth menu, in addition to usual Southern-style cuisine, included red soda water, as we called it, and barbecued goat. It was a day of excess for me and my friends on the soda water front. Soda was not part of our daily experience. It was more like a treat. Besides playing in my grandfather's front and backyard, lighting and throwing firecrackers, we spent the day pulling cans and bottles of soda out of large tin buckets filled with ice. I'm not sure why or how the tradition of eating goat started, as it was not common fare in Texas, as far as I knew. Our family indeed skipped eating the goat. My mother's stepfather had a small barbecuing business. People would bring meats to him to prepare, and he spent the day before and a good part of the day of the holiday fulfilling orders, some of which undoubtedly included goat.
If you didn't tell me you were talking about Juneteenth, I would be thinking maybe this is the 4th of July or some day like that.
I've sort of characterized it as Juneteenth to me growing up was like the 4th of July for Black people. I mean, we celebrated Juneteenth and we celebrated the 4th as well, but Juneteenth was supposed to be our, when I was a kid, I thought of it as our holiday.
So when we say we're going to celebrate Juneteenth, what is it that we're celebrating?
Well, we're celebrating, commemorating, and people go back and forth on those two words, June 19th, 1865, when Gordon Granger, U.S. Army Gordon Granger, came to Galveston and announced that slavery was over. This is 2 months after Lee had surrendered at Appomattox. This is after Lincoln's assassination. This is 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation had been put forth. And this was after the Confederate Army, the Army of the Trans-Mississippi, finally surrendered at the beginning of June. And when that happened, Granger went to Galveston and made the announcement.
You make the point in your writing about how word finally reached Texas that slavery had ended, but probably people had already heard that.
Well, they certainly heard in the immediate, you know, immediately before Granger gets to Galveston, there's evidence that people knew what he was going to say. But it's not so much that people didn't know about the Emancipation Proclamation. It's that the Army kept fighting. I mean, the United States Army was not in control of Texas during that time period, in the 2 years that since the Emancipation Proclamation. And you could know about it, but you couldn't make it a reality if the Army was not in control of the particular area. And it was a matter of the surrender. It was the surrender that allowed Gordon Granger to go in and make, you know, and to proclaim this.
And it wasn't just the news and the word information that slavery was over, but it was also the presentation that there's going to be an infrastructure to put this into place. And also the other part of the announcement that freed people who had been enslaved were equal.
Yeah. He says you're going to exist in a state of absolute equality with of rights and rights to property, which was pretty amazing thing to say, saying that people who had been treated as property and had been under the control of whites, both people, their legal owners, but socially, under the control of whites, would now, you know, according to this order, be treated as equal, be in a condition of absolute equality. And I'm sure that made, it was part of the jubilee, the jubilant response that enslaved people had to it, but it also, I think, accounted for some of the hostility that took place afterwards. White Southerners who had owned slaves and people who may have aspired to owning slaves deeply resented, obviously, the loss of the war. That's a resent is not that doesn't even begin to describe it. Were, you know, upset about the end of the war, the way things had turned out. But to have him say that they were going to be equals probably was rubbing salt in the wounds.
And then bringing about a structure to dismantle the institution of slavery, that had to be in place as well.
Yeah, it took a while, and they never really achieved it because there were never enough soldiers to cover all of the terrain to make sure all of everything happened. But they set up Freedmen's Bureau later on, and they were charged with, and it was charged with regulating the contracts between enslaved people and their former enslavers, and making sure that people were not mistreated. Because one of the things that happened, you know, in addition to the jubilation that these people felt, sometimes when they celebrated, they were punished. There are instances of people who were whipped, just as if they were still in slavery, for celebrating on Juneteenth. And, you know, it was, there were instances where people made blacks continue to work as slaves under threats of violence, because they were in control of society. It's only in the places where the army was able, you know, to go and to sort of maintain a presence that there was any semblance of a chance of bringing sort of normality and bringing them into the world of working for wages.
And we shifted into a sharecropper system, which in many ways resembled slavery. However, it did keep families intact.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, debt peonage. I mean, there was no land reform because there had been hopes for land reform that the former slaves would get land, which is what they wanted, to become farmers and to become self-sufficient. They were instead shunted into this system of debt peonage where they were still, you know, in many ways under the control of the same people who had been enslaving them. But it touched off a struggle. I mean, this was a happy and a jubilant moment, and I have no doubt that the people at the time understood that it was going to be a struggle, that it wouldn't be easy. But it, as you said, at least they knew that their children would not be sold from them, or their spouses and members of their family, which was always the most traumatic, one of the most traumatic things about slavery is the possibility of having your family members sold away from you, or be sold away from your family members, never to see them again.
Here we are today, Juneteenth, and the celebration kind of comes and goes, and it seems like it's making a comeback now. It was in recession not that long ago. And what to make of the fact that this history happened, and here we are today saying, it's Juneteenth, let's do something.
Yeah, it's amazing in a way, because as I said, when I was a little girl, I thought it was just a holiday for Black Texans. And then it became a state holiday, and other people began to celebrate it as well. And it gradually sort of gained momentum around the country. But in the last 2-3 years, it's really taken off. I read somewhere that last year there were more internet searches about Juneteenth than ever. There was sort of a surge in it. And I think, well, people have posited, I didn't come up with this, but people have posited that the murder of George Floyd made people think about race. It sort of opened a discussion of the issue of race. And the more you talk about the issue of race, if you talk about origins and origin stories, certainly slavery helped shape the racial landscape in the United States. So to have a holiday that invited you to think about emancipation to think about the people who were emancipated and think about what happened in the immediate aftermath of that, all that did happen and all that didn't happen. This is an occasion to have that discussion. And it may be no coincidence that it really has taken off in the public consciousness, even more than just the sort of state recognitions that we've seen over the years, but become a real focus during this moment when we're supposed to be having what people have called a reckoning about the subject of race. And you're right, it's always been celebrated, but the intensity of it kind of waxed and waned. But in the last 5 years, and certainly in the last 2 years, it's been just an amazing, not just in this country, but even overseas, interest in the holiday.
Of course, people will just assume, just looking at the surface level of this thought process, is thinking, well, it's a Black thing. It's an African-American holiday. And should we be broadening that? I mean, Martin Luther King saying that, you know, the ending of slavery was freeing white people as well from being part of this horrific institution. And should we be celebrating? I mean, I'm a white guy celebrating.
Yes, you should be celebrating. No, yes, you should be celebrating. White people can celebrate it as well, because it's not just about Black people. I mean, the emancipation, the process of emancipation meant something for Black Texans, for white Texans, for Americans, for world history. It's an event, what we would like to think is a positive event in human progress, in human rights, to realize that holding people as property was wrong and to have that wrong rectified. I think anybody can get behind that, because it's about it's an assertion of the importance of humanity, and that's the humanity of Black people, the humanity of white people, of all people, not treating people as means to an end. And that's a lesson that matters to, you know, to everybody, I would think. And I think that's why it's caught on, you know, that it's caught on. And that's why I think, as I suggested, that there's recognition of it and people want to talk about it overseas even.
But I mean, thank God I don't have to be part of the class that put people in bondage and defended the institution of slavery. I mean, I don't have to deal with that. I mean, that was done by my ancestors. Mm-hmm. And that's a liberating thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, it is a liberating thing. And it's because I think that Juneteenth is about, as I said, that some people call it a celebration. Some people call it a commemoration. I mean, commemoration, because you don't want to act as if everything was made all right with that one act, but it was an advance. But it's also thinking about the future. I mean, you look at the past and you see the things in the past that we now find abhorrent, and you have to say, we don't have to continue with that. We don't have to be held hostage to the way people thought about things in the past. We can do better than that. And I think for me, Juneteenth is a reminder of that. You look at the past, but you with a thought towards always trying to improve, to do better, and certainly do better in terms of treating people as human beings and not as things, not as items.
What about the fact that this is started out as a Texas event, and like, why Texas? I mean, surely New Orleans had their day, and other parts of the South also had their day when the word came and it was a change event. But the fact that we're nationally or internationally recognizing what happened in Galveston and spread through Texas, it does sort of speak to the outside role that Texas has in American culture.
Yep. That's it. And Texans have made a big deal of it. It came to other states when Texans who, you know, left Texas, went to California, other places, took the holiday with them and said, hey, you know, we celebrated this. Now you must too. And you should too.
People say, hey, it's a good idea.
It's a good idea. Well, it's a great day, because when I've been talking to people about how they celebrate it and what it means, it's essentially a family reunion, a community reunion. It's a day for family to get together. And, you know, you certainly think about what happened in the past, but it's very communal and very family oriented. And that's something that people of all races can get behind. You know, it's a day for outreach and a day for community. So I think that's one of the reasons that people have liked it so much, is that Texans have kept it alive. Yes, you're right. I believe Virginia looks to the fall of Richmond. This is April 3rd or April 4th, one of those. And that's a special day for them. But Virginians don't go around the country telling people that they ought to celebrate that day. And Texans have done that and made the case for the holiday. It's in the summer. It's perfect for the kind of things that you do. Barbecuing, getting together with family, and you know, playing dominoes, being social, all those kinds of things. And at the same time, thinking about, you hope, adults and teaching children, but to think about the people in the past who celebrated the end of their enslavement.
The thing about barbecuing and playing dominoes, so many stories come out during those times. And in the oral history that is passed down from generation to generation. That's also...
No, yeah, exactly. Very important.
And you talk about that in your book on Juneteenth, your great-grandmother and her connection to the realities of enslavement. So I was just talking to Clint Smith yesterday, author of How the Word Is Passed.
And great book.
It's a great book. You got to read these two back to back. He talks about how it wasn't that long ago. His son sits on his grandfather's lap, and his grandfather sat on his grandfather's lap, and the connection, the physical flesh connection to the horrors of enslavement. And you have that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My great grandmother, her mother was enslaved as a child. She was freed. She was born enslaved. She was freed as a child with her mother by her father, the man who owned them. And so my grandmother, my great grandmother, obviously knew her mother, who had been enslaved. Her mother also married her husband's died, was born enslaved, and lived as an enslaved man until the end of the Civil War. So my great grandparents and my grandmother knew people who had been slaves, and I know them. So this is not far back at all. And people, you know, think of it as long ago, but it really wasn't. And so it's hard to think of getting rid of all of that, getting rid of all of the attitudes that were forged in slavery, all of the beliefs that people had. They're still with us, and we were whittling away at it, but you can't expect it to all go away, and it hasn't. And one of the things that happened with the civil rights movement and other movements since then has been to try to combat those attitudes, to sort of do away with the idea of seeing African-American people as inferior and as black and white people necessarily being enemies to one another all the time. And that was certainly King's message and the message of the civil rights movement that included not just black people, but white Southerners, many white Southerners and white Northerners as well. People who wanted to do something to chart a different course.
And the trauma ripples through the generation like waves in the water. We have to think about that. And one thing that would be helpful is to stop re-traumatizing people so that we can reach some tranquility.
Yeah. The trauma is there. And people may not recognize it, may not recognize the source of it. But that's the great thing about history. And the great things about Clint's book as well is to get people who are going to these sites, Monticello. I did a workshop of the manuscript for that book, and I blurbed it. And he, because I know a lot about Monticello, and so he was talking to me about that. But people who go there who are surprised to find out that it's a plantation, the slave plantation, right? Or don't want to hear about slavery. You're sort of dismissing the trauma, dismissing the oppression that people who were enslaved there and people who, even in the aftermath of slavery, lived in an area that still treated them like second-class citizens. To not want to talk about that or to discuss those things is sort of, you know, denying something very real and something very powerful.
Your book is a memoir, and the stories are great. And you write about being a Texan. This is your view about being a Texan and mindful of Juneteenth in that way. And you talk about Texas history, how that is important to you. And do people sometimes say that this is in conflict?
Yeah, people do think it's in conflict. And I think it's because people are kind of either or binary, in very much the same way that people in Texas now, that I gather from reading the newspapers, are trying to prevent discussions of, or discourage, prevent, or whatever, discussions of race and slavery in classrooms.
They're outlawing
and so forth. Well, I'm putting a fine. Okay, outlawing. Let's go ahead. Let's put it this way. Outlawing discussions of race and slavery because it's not patriotic. And they think that they're fostering patriotic education. But to my mind, it is patriotic to be critical of a country. If you, anything that you really care about, you want improved. You know, to just say that it's all about some notion of love, that means that you're uncritical and you don't pay attention to flaws and you don't try to fix things. To my mind, is self-indulgent. It's not real. It's not real love. So I don't think it's in conflict at all. I mean, I love Texas because that's where I was born, and I grew up with my. I had a wonderful time there with my family, a good childhood with my family, my mother and my father and my brothers, and my family and my community. Wonderful things happened to me there. Not so wonderful things happened to me there, but that was life. I mean, you know, real living happened to me there. And I like the outsized nature of the place. I like some of the craziness of it, the sense of, you know, future orientation, enthusiasm, all those kinds of things I associate with Texas, which is kind of antithetical, this whole outlawing of history part of it. Because when I think of Virginia and other deep southern states, I think about places that are very, very, in some ways, hidebound. I mean, who are very much focusing on, you know, the aristocracy of Virginia, the FFV, they call them the first families of Virginia. And we have some of that in Texas, but I don't think we take it as seriously as they do in other places. Texas is supposed to be, to me, was always about the future and about, you know, what are we going to do next? And optimism and this looking back and saying you can't say anything, you can't tell the truth about the Texas Republic, which in the Constitution openly supports slavery and openly says that people of African descent can't be citizens. How are you going to hide that? How are you going to pretend that didn't happen? There's no way of doing that. And so to my mind, that's not love. That's something else. It's self-indulgence. And it's in some ways, and not in some ways, it is disrespectful of the history of Black Texans, whose ancestors, you know, have lived there for centuries and deserve to have their stories told.
So I'm in San Antonio, not that far from the border with Mexico, 150 miles. We had our own underground railroad where people seeking to breaking out of escaping from slavery would flee to Mexico.
Yep.
We had, at the time, the indigenous population, Comanche, and would give them safe passage to the border. There was a community across the Rio Grande, and which became a community of freed slaves, indigenous people, and Mexican citizens. And San Antonio was like, we want our slaves back. So they hired Texas Rangers to go down into Mexico to grab them and bring them back. When they arrived, this posse of Texas Rangers, they basically had a shootout, and the freed slaves and the Mexican citizens and the indigenous people came together and fought off the Texas Rangers. And the Texas Rangers fled, setting fire to the town as they left. But to me, that story just tells me so much about coming together to protect each other during troubled times.
Mm-hmm.
And those stories need to be told.
Yeah, they do need to be told. And what is so interesting to me about Texas, one of the things that I wanted people to see, you know, as I've said, is that this place was a multi-ethnic, multi-racial space from the very beginning. It's not like a situation where a state is becoming, you know, more, Minnesota is becoming more diverse or other places. This is what we start out with people of Spanish origin, indigenous people, people of African descent, Anglo-Americans, you know, European-Americans. It's all of that mixture has been there from the beginning and has made it a very volatile place. There are points of cooperation and points of not cooperation as well. I mean, there were some native groups who held African Americans as slaves. And they too right now are going through a reckoning about that. But there were other places, other instances where they did cooperate and it made a difference.
So why did you write this book?
I wanted to explain or try to talk about Texas to people for a very long time. And now it just seemed a good moment. I was here in Manhattan in the pandemic. We couldn't go anywhere besides. And I was thinking about my parents who are no longer living, but thinking about how they would have coped, what they would have thought of this moment that we're in right now. And thinking about them made me want to write about them and write about our lives together. So that's why I wrote it.
And who do you want to read it?
Everybody. But I particularly want people in Texas to read it. I would love for young people in Texas. This is the kind of book I would have liked when I was a high school student in Texas, I think, you know, that talks about history through the eyes of a narrator. With whom I might be able to identify. But I think I wrote it for the country as a whole, but I think I would like for it to be a Texas history book, you know, that people will look to. And that's why I put so much history in it and why I had myself in it, but the real, and my family in it, but the real focus is on Texas.
Well, yeah, but it's very comforting. You know, if you're a young person and you're trying to make sense of Texas and you do love Texas, but you feel sometimes that you're at odds with it and maybe Texas may not love you that much, you're trying to make sense of it all. It does seem like you've been there.
Yep, I have been there. And what I, as I said before, what I've decided is that, you know, there are people in Texas who don't love me. Texas is mine, too. And it belongs to the people who are born and live there and have lived there and want to have that identification. And I can't let the negative feelings of other people do me out of that.
Annette Gordon Reed is the author of On Juneteenth. She's a professor of history at Harvard University and a recipient of the Pulitzer for her book, The Hemingses of Monticello. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us at texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also comment on our website at tpr.org. That's where you can find past Texas Matters programs. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.